Well, tonight, brothers and sisters, Brother Nat is to give us his address, Abraham the Prophet. He's asked that we introduce his remarks with a reading from Genesis chapter 12, and we've asked Joel to read that for us, please. Thank you, Joel. So, with that introduction, we ask Brother Nat to come and speak to us on Abraham the Prophet. Nat.
Well, good evening, brothers and sisters. The title for tonight's address was actually, I've had it in mind for some years. It came out of a conversation I had with Brother Norman Mitchell many years ago in Poland, and someone described Abraham as a prophet, and he was sort of surprised. We hadn't thought of Abraham that way, and I think Sister Marion pointed out that he was indeed referred to as a prophet, and it's in this little passage in Genesis 20 when it's the words of God to Abimelech in the time when Abraham had gone into the territory of the Philistines, and Abimelech had taken Sarah as to potentially be his wife. And God appears to Abimelech and says, "Restore to this man his wife, for he is a prophet, and he shall pray for thee, and thou shalt live." And we sort of thought that this would be quite a good subject for a Bible class, and I finally got round to doing it. I'm very aware that I've merely scratching the surface of what could be said this evening, but hopefully it'll be a reasonable introduction to the subject. Just a quick word before we leave the title. We're aware that prophet can be a more general term for teacher or wise man, but I would say it most commonly in the scriptures includes the idea of foretelling of the future. And just one very quick example to bring that home from the law. When a prophet speaketh in the name of the Lord, if the thing follow not nor come to pass, that is the thing which the Lord hath not spoken, but the prophet hath spoken it presumptuously. So the idea of a prophet is someone who, through the Spirit of God, can actually predict future events, and that is part of his purpose in being sent by God. Now, as I say, so that's the aspect that we'd like to concentrate on this evening, just picking out some of the events of Abraham's life and looking at how they foreshadow future events, particularly in the for his natural descendants in Israel, but also the echoes that we have in our own life and in the overall purpose of God. Now, the record of Abraham, just starts a few verses before the passage that we read together, at the end of chapter 11, at the end of the genealogies after the flood. It's chapter 11, verse 27, which describes the Abraham's ancestors, and also the leaving of Terah, that's Abraham's father, and his family from the place of their birth, which was Ur of the Chaldees. And when we come on to chapter 12, we have this verses 1 to 3 of chapter 12, and it's really the first time that we're introduced to Abraham and his relationship with God. And it's significant, surely, that this actually includes a prophecy. It's the command that we know very well for Abraham to leave his father's household, to go into this land that God was to show him, and God predicts that he will there become a great nation, and that he would be a blessing. So I think we're actually quite familiar with the idea that Abraham his whole life, his whole the record we have from is bound up with prophecy. And that's particularly true of when we look at the promises that were made to him. Now, we talk about the promises a lot, so we're not going to specifically talk very much about them, except I'll come on to them at the end, but concentrate on some of the other aspects of Abraham's life. And as I mentioned, we're going to take a fairly broad brush approach to this. So I'd like to begin by really just going through the main events of Abraham's life. And this is where your handout comes in, because I've attempted to sort of summarize just go through the record from chapter 11, verse 29, down to his death in Genesis chapter 25, and just pick out what I think are key events. And I'll attempt to, where it's mentioned that he moves somewhere, I'll put that up on the screen. So by comparing your handout and the screen, you can get an idea of what's happening to Abraham, and also whereabouts. It gives an idea of some of the places he spent his life. Remember, he's described in the NIV at least as a wandering Aramean, and I think we'll see how that's true as we go through this evening. The other point just to make is that basically what we're reading about in Abraham's life is the last 100 years. If you look on the left-hand column of your handout, that has Abraham's age for the particular event. Then the middle column is the event, and then the reference on the right-hand side. And I think there are three key events that happen sometime to Abraham before he left Haran for Canaan at age 75. And we don't really know quite what order or when exactly these happened. And the first one, just get the little red dot up there on the screen. Oh, I have this incredibly powerful pointer, which I will blind you with occasionally. Thanks, Mitt, for that. Oh, I should thank Joel as well for typing out my handout, otherwise you wouldn't have that either. So the first thing we read about Abraham is that he married Sarah, or Sarai at this stage, sometime in Ur, sometime before the age of 75. Then he receives this call from God to leave the land and his father's family and go to this land that God would show him. And it's not immediately clear from the record in Genesis whether that happened in Ur or in Haran. But I think it's fairly clear. For example, if we look over to Acts 7, verse 2, and there are other passages which support this idea, it's actually Stephen's defense. And it's pretty clear that Stephen at least believed that Abraham was called in Ur. Acts 7, verse 2, and Stephen said, "Men, brethren, and fathers, hearken. The God of glory appeared unto our father Abraham when he was in Mesopotamia before he dwelt in Haran." So it's quite clear that the call Abraham received was before he had moved to Haran with his family. And Haran, as I'm sure you know, is towards the top of the Fertile Crescent there. Again, the dots are a little bit approximate, but it gives you a rough idea of where he was. And in Haran, his father Terah dies. And at some point after that, at age 75, as recorded in Genesis 12, verse 4, Abraham leaves Haran for the land of Canaan, which was the original destination which God was pointing him to. And then if we come down to verse 6 to 7, we find that Abraham arrives in the land, and he settles in Shechem, which is right in the middle of the land, where you see the dot there. Shortly afterwards, there's a famine in the land, and he moves down to Egypt, and I'm sure you all know where Egypt is. We don't know exactly where in Egypt. Then we have the incident we read about where Sarai is taken as Pharaoh's wife, and then Pharaoh sort of rejects Abraham and his wife. And after that point, they move out of Egypt and settle in the south of the land. And if we go to Genesis 13, verses 3 to 4, we read that he wandered in the south until he reached Bethel. And this really, which is down here, if you've got a map in the back of your Bibles, it might be easier to look at that because the place name is a little bit indistinct on this one. But this really sets the scene for the rest of Abraham's life, and he seems to have spent most of it in this southern part of the land, between Bethel, the Philistine territory, and Beersheba in the south. It's really very much concentrated in the south. Then we go through the various events with Lot, separating from Lot. There's the time when Lot is taken with the kings of Sodom and Abraham rescues him from them. Then at age 85, probably the next key event, Genesis 16, is that he marries Hagar. We're told that happened after he'd been in Canaan for 10 years. So simple maths gives us an age of 85 here. Again, we're not exactly sure where Abraham was at this stage, but when we come to chapter 16 and look at verses 10 to 12, we're given, before I come on to that, in Bethel, where after the Abraham separates from Lot, he's told to look, the very famous time when God tells Abraham to look in the land. And I just have a picture here, just for interest's sake. This is approximately the view that he might have had. It looks pretty desolate today. Obviously, that's a fairly recent picture. I imagine the topography may not have changed very much, but this is obviously before the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, so the vegetation may have been rather different when Abraham was told to look at the land that he was to inherit and walk up and down in it. Then, as we say, he married Hagar. There was the conflict between Hagar and Sarai. And when Hagar runs away from her mistress, we're told that she was given a promise by God in a very specific place. It was on the chapter 16, verses 10 to 12, is the promise to Hagar. And it's, I've lost the exact reference, but it's in the well between Kadesh and Bered on the road to Shur. And this map here shows the road to Shur, and we have Kadesh here. We're not sure where Bered is. But again, it indicates that Abraham was living in the south of the land at this stage. Then the next sort of geographical note comes in 18 verse 14, where we're told that the angels appear to Abraham at the great trees of Mamre. And again, we're in the south of the land, and Mamre is here, right near Hebron, a little bit further south from Bethel, where we had the altar that Abraham made. Then the next thing that happens after the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah is that Abraham moves to the Negev, and specifically to Gerar in what's described as the land of the Philistines. There we have this incident with Abimelech, which we mentioned right at the beginning of the talk, where Abraham's described as a prophet. And it's in this sort of area that Isaac is born when Abraham is 100 years old. And again, after 13 years, Hagar and Ishmael, when they're sent away, it's described as the desert of Beersheba, Beersheba being in the south down here. So again, it's the idea is that Abraham is very much in the south of the land. I think the last, well, there's two more geographical points. One is in chapter 21 or chapter 22, verses 4 to 19, and when Abraham is told to sacrifice Isaac, it's described as a 3-day journey before they meet, they reach Mount Moriah, and we're told that he was actually living in Beersheba at the time. which being about 40 miles from Jerusalem would fit in with that. Then when we come to the death of Sarah in chapter 23, the cave of Machpelah, which Abraham buys, is near Mamre again. So we're back in this southern part of the land near Hebron. So the reason for sort of ploughing through this lot, I think, because it's really the first time I certainly had ever tried to summarise Abraham's life and get an idea of where he'd wandered in during his life, and to summarise the main events. Perhaps one little point before we move on from this is that chapter 25 describes his marriage to Keturah and the descendants that he has from them. Now, this could well have happened after the death of Sarah, but not necessarily. So when we're going through the chronology of Genesis, as with a lot of the chronologies in the Bible, we're not sure if the chapters are actually in chronological order or not. I'm assuming for the purposes of this evening that they basically are. So, as I've said, the plot of Abraham's life, I think, will, as we go through this evening, shows that he actually enacts, in some way, many of the key events in God's purpose. One little point is that the geography is very specific. We are told of very literal places that Abraham went to, where he lived, the people he interacted with, and we can identify where they are today. So we're always talking about a very literal land. There's nothing... it's a very corporeal place. It's somewhere we can go today if we want to. Another point which I'll try and pick up on towards the end of this evening is that I think the details of God's purpose are refined throughout Abraham's life. It starts off very general, and as we go through, we find more and more specific details of God's purpose being enacted or introduced by God. So let's begin with Abraham's original journey. Basically, he travelled from Ur to Canaan to Egypt. And again, very broad sweep, this unites the three main areas of the land, or three key areas that God is interested in. That is Assyria, Canaan, and Egypt. And I think the best summary of that is in Isaiah 19, verse 24, which is speaking of the end of God's purpose. And it identifies, again, the same three regions. Isaiah 19, verse 24, "In that day there shall be a highway out of Egypt to Assyria, and the Assyrian shall come into Egypt, and the Egyptian into Assyria, and the Egyptians shall serve with the Assyrians. In that day shall Israel be the third with Egypt and with Assyria, even the blessing in the midst of the land." So it's wholly appropriate that Abraham, in his very first journey, should unite these three key areas. And I'd like to spend the next few minutes just looking at the time that Abraham spent outside the land of promise. And there are two occasions when this happened. First one is, as we've read in chapter 12, when he goes to Egypt. And the second is in chapter 20, when he goes into the Philistine territory at Gerar. And I think there are some key or very interesting points to make from this. There are some interesting comparisons and contrasts between these two events. So let's look at the sojourn. Well, I've called it the sojourn in Egypt. It was, for want of a better phrase. I think this prefigures the time of Joseph to Moses. And I think one of the key things is that it happened before the covenant of circumcision. Abraham wasn't circumcised until much later in his life, just after the promise of Isaac when he was 99 years old. When he goes into Egypt, he's certainly sometime between 75 and 85, because it's before he marries Hagar, and it's probably fairly soon after he actually entered Canaan. So in this way, it exactly parallels the state of Israel nationally, who are only constituted as a nation after the Exodus. Effectively, Abraham is still Abraham at this stage. It's before he's made this special covenant relationship with God. He went to Egypt because of the famine in 12:10. exactly the same reason that Jacob's family originally went to Egypt. He felt in mortal danger, whether justifiably or not, and that's clear in verse 12 of Genesis 12, Abraham's words to Sarai: "It shall come to pass when the Egyptians shall see thee that they shall say, 'This is his wife,' and they will kill me, but they will save thee alive." And I think this parallels the danger that the national Israelites were in at the time of the Exodus. Another quite interesting point is that he was actually enriched by the Egyptians. if we look at verse 16 of chapter 12, reads Pharaoh's response to Abraham when he took Sarai to be his wife. "He entreated Abraham well for her sake, and he had sheep and oxen and he asses and men servants and maid servants and she asses and camels." So the Egyptians gave Abraham a great deal of wealth. And it's interesting that this seems to have materially affected his wealth, because it's only after this point that the quantity of his possessions are commented on. If we look, for example, through to chapter 13, verse 2, after Abraham left Egypt, it says, "Abraham was very rich in cattle, in silver, and in gold." Now, the only other time in this sort of period that Abraham's possessions are commented on is in verse 5 of chapter 12. It says, "Abraham took Sarai his wife and Lot his brother's son and all their substance that they had gathered and the souls that they had gotten in Haran, and they went forth to go into the land of Canaan." So although Abraham obviously had a substantial household before he entered Canaan, it seems to have this generosity of Pharaoh seems to have been a great foundation for his later wealth. And it's also interesting that Abraham accepts these gifts from Pharaoh, and we'll look later at when the king of Sodom offers Abraham wealth, and he refuses it. And I think there's a key difference there. And one last parallel is that the Egyptians were plagued before Abraham left, and that's from Genesis 12, verse 17. "The Lord plagued Pharaoh and his house with great plagues because of Sarai, Abraham's wife." So I think we've got here a very clear prediction of what was going to happen to Israel later on, the descendants of Abraham. But it's also, I think there's a deeper significance, which there's more types to this, and I think this is why Jesus also had to go to Egypt. Little reference in Matthew, which I'm sure you're well aware of, after describes the actions of Joseph. "He took the young child and his mother by night and departed into Egypt, and was there until the death of Herod, that it might be fulfilled which was spoken of the Lord by the prophet, saying, 'Out of Egypt have I called my son.'" So it's important that this type was upheld by Abraham, by natural Israel, and also by God's son. So looking at the later one, the sojourn in Gerar, and this is recorded in Genesis 20, this was after the covenant of circumcision. So if we're looking for parallels in Israel's history, it would be sometime after the Exodus, after they've been constituted as a nation with this special relationship to God. Significantly, I think Abraham at this stage, didn't go into Gerar because of famine. He was there anyway, and at this stage, Abimelech saw Sarah and took him to be his wife. And again, Abraham felt in mortal danger because of his proximity to these Gentiles. Genesis 20, verse 11. Abraham said, "Because I thought, surely the fear of God is not in this place, and they will slay me for my wife's sake." Again, he's enriched by the Gentiles. This is after Abimelech has returned Sarah to her husband, in contrast to Pharaoh, who gave the riches beforehand. And it's almost to compensate Sarah and Abraham for the potential loss of reputation or whatever that Abimelech felt could have resulted from his actions. Verse 14 of chapter 20, "Abimelech took sheep and oxen and men servants and women servants and gave them unto Abraham and restored him Sarah his wife." And verse 16, "And unto Sarah he said, Behold, I have given thy brother 1,000 pieces of silver. Behold, he is to thee a covering of the eyes unto all that are with thee and with all other. Thus she was reproved." And the NIV makes it clear that this was a compensation to them. Again, Abraham and Sarah are released after a plague on their hosts. Verse 17 of chapter 20, "So Abraham prayed unto God, and God healed Abimelech and his wife and his maidservants, and they bare children. For the Lord had fast closed up all the wombs of the house of Abimelech because of Sarah, Abraham's wife." And in this case, the nation was healed through Abraham. So I think this is looking forward, possibly, to the later captivities of the nation of Israel, both in the past and potentially in the future as well. And it highlights some of the differences between them and the times of the Exodus. It also has some interesting follow-ons at the time of Abraham. I think it helps set the limits of the land. Abraham has felt specifically in danger when he was with Abimelech and when he was with Pharaoh. And I think that's because he'd strayed outside the limits of the land of promise. But because of this, he felt that he could accept gifts from them. It didn't compromise him any way. And in fact, in Genesis 21, verse 22, we read of Abraham making a treaty with Abimelech at Beersheba. And a little bit later on, as we go through the record, I haven't really highlighted it on this sheet, but there are specific mentions of the people who lived in the land of promise, the ones who would be ejected by Abraham's descendants. And one example is here in Genesis 15. This is when God has made this covenant, has repeated the covenant to Abraham. And in fact, he's predicted the time of Israel in Egypt and the Exodus. And he lists here, or he spells out to Abraham very specifically the land, the boundaries of the land of promise. Genesis 15, verses 18 to 21. "The same day the Lord made a covenant with Abraham, saying, Unto thy seed have I given this land, from the river of Egypt unto the great river, the river Euphrates, the Kenites and the Kenizzites and the Kadmonites and the Hittites and the Perizzites and the Rephaims, and the Amorites and the Canaanites and the Girgashites and the Jebusites." And these people would have had specific territories that Abraham was aware of, and that would help limit or identify the boundaries of the land he had been promised. I'd like to now just pick out another interesting event, which I think is particularly rich in echoes of the future. And that's the time when Abraham rescued Lot from a northern invader. And this is recorded in chapter 14 of Genesis, which I think we should look at now. Now again, you could spend the whole evening on this, and I believe that Brother Howard did an address on Genesis 14 a few years ago, which obviously he went into more detail of this. But it does seem to have some very strong echoes of the future, not just for Abraham, but also for us, and the events that are going to take place in the land of Israel. I've just put here a list of the main characters. Genesis 14 describes a rebellion by these five kings on the right-hand side, who had been vassals of Chedorlaomer, king of Elam. And it describes their rebellion and the response of Chedorlaomer and his allied kings. And as we'll see, they came and crushed them. If we go through this list, it's quite interesting to identify the areas that these people were from. Amraphel, king of Shinar. Shinar is a plain in Babylonia. It's the, as I'm sure you're aware, the site of the Tower of Babel. Elasar, again, I'm taking these identifications from speaker's commentary, so they're probably fairly accurate. Elasar apparently is a town in Lower Babylonia, between Ur and Erech. So again, it's way over to the east of the Fertile Crescent. Again, Elam, the mountainous country east of the Tigris, so way over beyond Ur. And then, interestingly, this Tidal, king of nations. Now, the original Hebrew there is Goyim. Where is it? In verse 1 of Genesis 14. Look at where the King James has Tidal, king of nations. I believe the NIV actually has a literal translation there. Yeah, Tidal, king of Goyim. Now, I'm sure you're aware that a Goy today is the Jews' description of a Gentile, or someone who isn't Jewish. The suggestion that this is possibly, at the time, this was a nomadic chief, and possibly based in the sort of northern area, Galilee-type area, but it's very speculative. But I think that's a particularly rich symbolic name, isn't it? Tidal, king of nations, allied with these other kings from the Babylonian area. On the other hand, we have these five kings. Interestingly, none of them named, just their regions. Sodom and Gomorrah, we know, roughly in the region of the Dead Sea today. And again, Admah and Zeboim, we really don't know where they are, but they're conjectured, again, to be in the similar region. Zoar, we do seem to know, king of Bela, or Zoar, it's the place where Lot fled to after the destruction, or just before the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, and it's situated just south of the Dead Sea. So again, we have a very specific region identified. We then read of the invasion of these northern kings into the land. And if we go through, I believe it's, where are we? Yes, it's in the sort of verse 5 and 6 of Genesis 14, describes the campaign of these kings. Starts off with the Rephaim. Now, O king of Bashan was described as the last of the Rephaim, or the giants, and they were they lived sort of northeast of the Jordan Valley up here. The Zuzims in Han, they're suggested that these are probably the region of the Ammonites, a little bit further down, but still on the east bank of the Jordan. Then come to the plain of Kiriathaim. Now, Kiriathaim is actually that town there. Dazzled you with this. Then it goes on to Mount Seir, which we know is in Edom. Then the Vale of Siddim, which was possibly the desert of Sinai, so further south down here off the map. Yes, far as El Paran, near the desert, described as the desert of Paran, was further to the west over here. And it describes them as coming, turning back to En Mishpat, that is Kadesh. Kadesh, I think, is my last ring there. Conquered the whole territory of the Amalekites based in the southern part of the land, and who were living in Hazazon Tamar. So we basically got this idea of a sweep down the eastern bank of the Jordan, down into the Sinai Peninsula, and then back up again to this area. And the battle was joined in the Valley of Siddim, which is probably the valley of the Dead Sea today. The kings of Sodom and Gomorrah and so on were defeated, and then it's fairly vague. It just says they carried off Abraham's nephew Lot and his possessions and so on. So they probably headed north back to their territory, and I would imagine up the east bank of the Jordan again, which they'd suppressed on the way in. Then we're told that Abraham took his trained servants and attacked these kings victorious, and pursued them to Dan in the north of the land up here, and then as far as the Hobah north of Damascus, and Damascus being way up to the northeast over here. So basically, Abraham defeated these kings who'd been incredibly successful and drove them back northwards to where they'd come from. Very dramatic time in Abraham's life, and I think it prefigures a very dramatic time that we're looking for in the future. Because I think these people have a future significance, don't they? The kings of Sodom and Gomorrah, Revelation identifies this as being Jerusalem, apostate Jerusalem. Revelation 11 verse 8, describing the death of the two witnesses: their dead bodies shall lie in the street of the great city, which spiritually is called Sodom and Egypt, where also our Lord was crucified. So I think here we have an indication that Jerusalem in the future is identified. But in that place was a righteous man, well-known words from Peter, delivered just Lot. That righteous man dwelling among them in seeing and hearing vexed his righteous soul from day to day. And it's this righteous remnant that is interesting to Abraham in defeating them. So just a little summary here of the essence of what Abraham achieved. There's a northern confederacy which invaded and devastated the land. It eventually reaches symbolic Jerusalem, in this case Sodom. The inhabitants were captured, and then the northern invader is destroyed by the righteous. And then, as I'm sure we're aware, when we look to Genesis 14, verse 18, Abraham meets with Melchizedek, the king of Salem, or the prince of peace. And just one echo of this is in perhaps Zechariah 14, the prophecy of the last days: I will gather all nations against Jerusalem to battle. Remember this title, King of the Nations. The city shall be taken, the houses rifled, the women ravished. Half the city shall go in forth into captivity. The residue of the people shall not be cut off from the city. Then shall the Lord go forth and fight against those nations as when he fought in the day of battle. And I think we've seen Abraham prefiguring that in the events of his life here. And as we've just mentioned, in Genesis 14, verses 18 to 20, we read that Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought forth bread and wine. He was the priest of the Most High God, and he blessed him and said, "Blessed be Abraham of the Most High God, possessor of heaven and earth." And this is picked up in Hebrews 7, which again looks forward to the sort of final fulfillment of this. Abraham gave him a tenth of everything. First, his name, that's Melchizedek's name, means king of righteousness. Then also king of Salem means king of peace, without father or mother, without genealogy, without beginning of days or end of life. Like the Son of God, he remains a priest forever. And here we surely have an echo of the time when the righteous will fellowship with the Son of God, this priest after the order of Melchizedek. I'd like to finish by just having a quick look through the times when the promises are given. Now, as you glance through your handout, you'll see that there are a number of times when the promises were made or repeated or elaborated on by God, and I've highlighted them in red. There's one in orange, that isn't a mistake, that's actually a promise which was made to Hagar, so although it's significant and it obviously affects the descendants of Abraham, it wasn't specifically given to Abraham himself, it was given to Hagar. And I think the reason for doing it, just a very sort of quick summary, is that I think it helps to emphasize this idea that the focus of God's purpose was increased through Abraham's life. It started very broadly, and it was then channeled down, and more details were given, particularly through the medium of the promises, but also in some of the events towards the end of Abraham's life. So if we start at chapter 12, verse 1, the first time we read of the promises, it's a very general one. Sorry, just find the right reference. It's a call to a new land and a promise of blessing to all nations. As we go down chapter 12, we have the promise repeated in verses 6 to 7, and here the land is specified. When we come over to chapter 13, verse 18, again with the reference to the nations, the extent of the land starts to be identified. This is when Abraham is told to walk up and down in the length of it and the breadth of it, just after he leaves Lot. Then in chapter 15, verse 18, we referred to this earlier, there's a prediction of the heir. So now we have the means by which this promise is to be fulfilled starting to be elaborated on. There's a specific prediction of the persecution in Egypt and the exodus of his descendants, and also, as we've seen, an identification of the nations in the land. Then in chapter 16, there's the promise to Hagar, which again is slightly at a tangent, but it identifies again certain of Abraham's descendants and what was going to happen to them. Then in chapter 17, absolutely crucial point here. This is where Abraham's name is changed to Abraham. He's described as now the father of nations. When he's given the covenant of circumcision, which specifically identified his descendants as having this special relationship with God. And then the specific promise of Isaac as the chosen seed through whom the promises were going to be fulfilled. Then in chapter 18, verse 10, we have the timing of Isaac's birth predicted. So not just a vague promise that Isaac would be born, but very specifically that he would be born within the year. And if you look at your time chart, that happened when Abraham was 99. And it's 13 years, as we know, after Ishmael was born, when Abraham was told that the promise would be through Isaac. So it's a wait there. That's the specific times when God spoke to Abraham about the promises. But I think there are two other crucial events which bear on this. The next one is in chapter 22, when this is the sacrifice of Isaac. And again, this is very rich in echoes of the future. But it specifies another detail on how God's purpose was to be worked out through the sacrifice of the chosen offspring, this lamb that God would provide, which was prefigured at that time. And then in chapter 23, verses 1 to 20, we have a description of the death of Sarah, and it goes into great details about how Abraham actually purchased this field. And that's the only part of the land that Abraham ever actually owned. So again, I think that's very specific. It's actually, in, if you like, it's the start of the fulfillment in that Abraham actually owned part of the land. As I said to begin with, there's a lot more we could say. We've really run out of time. I think the richness of Abraham's life in typology could occupy us for quite a few evenings. But I suppose the take-home message is that in spite of his amazing life, the things he achieved, the visions he had from God, the specific promises that were made to him, Abraham only had a very limited experience of the fulfillment of all that God had said to him. He owned one cave in the land. He had a few descendants, but they certainly weren't as numerous as the stars in the sky or the sand on the seashore. And really, we could finish with these verses from Hebrews 11, verses 39 to 40. These all died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off, and were persuaded of them, and embraced them, and confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. And I'm sure Abraham recognized that his life was significant, but may not have understood all that the events were pointing forward to, and we've been able to look at a few of those this evening. And the life of this wandering Aramean looks forward to a far greater future that each of us can share in. These all, having obtained a good report through faith, received not the promise, God having provided some better thing for us, that they without us should not be made perfect. And this better thing, this perfect fulfillment of all these types, is what we're, each of us here is hoping for.